The Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to Women with Balls, where I, Katie Ball, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today was born in Birmingham to migrant parents. After studying law at Lincoln College, Oxford, where Rishi Sunak was a contemporary, she qualified as a barrister and lived and worked in London. She was then elected to Parliament in 2010, representing her home constituency of Birmingham Ladywood, and she was one of the first female Muslim MPs in UK Parliament. She is now the only Muslim member of the Shadow Cabinet. She served under Ed Miliband as well as Keir Starmer, but she did not serve under Jeremy Corbyn. Starmer appointed her the Shadow Secretary of State for Justice last year, and she will be the first female Justice Secretary for the Labour Party if the party wins the next election. My guest today is Shabana Mahmood. Shabana, thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Now, we usually start by asking the same question, which is, was your childhood a happy one? I think you spent the first couple of years of your life after being born here in Saudi Arabia.
That's right, yes. No, I had a very happy childhood. Slightly varied in experience, as you said. I was born here. I have a twin brother. So we were both born 1980. And then soon afterwards, my dad, because he's a civil engineer, so he was posted out to work for a British company out in Saudi. So we moved to Taif. We also lived in Jeddah. We spent most of our weekends either in Mecca, at the main mosque there, or at the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, which, you know, as family of Muslims, that was a really special experience. So a lot of my early memories are of almost seeing like some of the most holiest sites in Islam as a child, like a playground, because, you know, we had a lovely time with our parents, performed the Hajj on my dad's shoulder as a three-year-old. So yeah, no, that was a lovely start in life. So none of it was really Arab in nature at all, actually. So I didn't learn Arabic. Went to a school for the children of British and a small number of American expats.
Like an international school.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I came back with a very, very posh home counties accent because
I always think sometimes the international school accent's a little bit American, but yours was more British.
It was very home counties because our teachers were very home counties, and so obviously my main experiences of speaking English were in this very home counties dominated environment, which when we returned to Birmingham full time in, I think it was sort of 1987 after my grandfather passed away.
And did everyone think you were super posh?
100%. And also it's why I don't really have a hugely strong Brummy accent now, and everyone is always thrown by the fact that I'm a born and bred Brummy, but it is because I had this sojourn in Saudi Arabia. My Brummy accent is strongest when I'm speaking in Mirpuri, which is a Kashmiri dialect, funnily enough, but not so much in English.
And how was it coming back to the UK?
I mean, we returned fairly regularly in the period that we were there. So my younger siblings, brother and sister, they were all born in the UK as well. So we did make regular trips home. But obviously living here full time, we came because my granddad passed away. And, you know, my dad's the eldest son and sort of took on family responsibilities. And it was a bit of a culture shock being here full time. As I say, the accent suddenly became a thing. We spoke not Mirpuri, we spoke Urdu because my mum had taught us that language when we were in Saudi Arabia. She didn't want us to lose that additional sort of heritage. But everybody we knew in Birmingham spoke the other dialect, and suddenly communication was a bit of an odd experience. But my posh accent sort of got a bit beaten out of me, and the Urdu lost its way and Mirpuri replaced it. And then going to school here was very different to being a tiny international school in Saudi, where there's no more than 15 students at any one time, and suddenly you're in a class alone of 30 in a playground of hundreds of kids. That was very different.
So how old were you when you started going to school in the UK?
Seven.
Okay. Because I think you spoke in the past about failing the 11 plus.
Oh God, so, yes. My
not to start on this note. Well, maybe talk us through that. But I also wanted in terms of kind of changing schools and obviously different kind of ways of teaching, one of that may have had an impact in it.
I was always very academic, and I always describe my childhood actually as having my head in a book. So I love studying. I know I sound like a super geek here, but I just absolutely loved learning, and I guess maybe a bit of a girly swot and quite proud of that as well. A bit of a teacher's pet kind of person, but I love studying. I love doing well. It was just a thing. And that was the same in Saudi as it was when I got to my junior school in Birmingham. Annoyingly, I was one of those people that everyone just assumed would pass. You know, when you're academically able and you're sort of always at the top of the class, people just think things come really easily to you. And of course you're going to pass. Even from quite a young age, I would always feel a bit of pressure from that because people just think things come easy to you. And I'm like, no, I did work. It's not like I just magicked it out of nowhere. And around the 11 plus, there's a lot of projection. I didn't have the words to describe it when I was 11. But as I got older, I thought, all right, people project their insecurities onto you when they think either it comes easily for you or if annoyingly when you failed, which I personally always knew was a possibility because you can have a bad day. But then other people are like, well, if you failed, it's fine for me. And I thought, great, thanks for that. So
you gave hope to others.
I gave hope to others through my failure. Yeah, I didn't really plan it that way. And I was personally quite gutted for a long time. I felt like, you know, I'd let myself down. I was worried I'd let my parents down. They were fine about it. They said these things happen. My mum actually, I remember, said, well, all you can ever do is try your best. And if you know you tried your best, then you've got to be able to live with whatever. You're a winner, basically, and you've got to live with whatever happens after that.
Yeah, I mean, and you went on to study law at Oxford. So yeah. I think we can conclude it didn't massively set you back.
Yeah. Well, the school I failed to get into when I was 11 is the school I then went to do my A-levels, which helped me get into Oxford.
Okay, so you got there.
The story came full circle in the end.
And did you have early career ambitions in the sense, did you always know you wanted to be, was it a lawyer first? Was politics when you were growing up something that was discussed much, or what were you thinking as the girly swat?
Yeah, as the girly swat. So both were a part of my life, but I never thought of politics as a career or as a job that I might do for myself. I wanted to be a barrister from quite a young age. I sort of wanted to be a barrister before I fully knew what one was. But
how had you seen it? TV?
Yes, I wanted to be Kavanaugh QC, but that came a little bit later. When I was younger, people said, oh, God, Siobhan, you're really good at talking and you love an argument. You'd be great in a court. You should be a barrister. And I was like, oh, I don't know what that is, but it sounds really great. And as you do when you're quite young. But then as I got more into it, learned more about it. And definitely by the time I was watching Kavanaugh QC as a teenager, I thought, I want to be him. That looks cool. And honestly, that was my career track. I decided early. I stuck with it. Every time I did any kind of work experience, it was always in a legal setting. I did mini pupillages for like a week at a time at different chambers in Birmingham. And I just came back completely enthused, and I knew that was what I wanted to do with my life.
So you get into Oxford, 11 plus is well behind you. How did you find Oxford when you got there? Was it very different kind of your experience at school? Did you feel like it was somewhere that you belonged, or what was it like?
I definitely felt like a fish out of water. I felt like a bit of an alien. In Birmingham, where I'd been to different schools. So I'd been to, when we returned from Saudi and I went to junior school, my twin brother and I were the only two Asian faces in the school, and my best friend was the only black girl in the school. And, you know, we were very much minorities, right? And first experiences of racism were all at junior school.
And did you have those?
Yes. Yeah. No. I remember I was one of the boys in my class called Jamie called me a Paki. I think I was 7 and a half, just coming up to 8 years old. It was the first time I'd ever heard that word in my life. My best friend Earlene had to explain to me that it's like an equivalent of the N-word. I didn't know what the N-word was either. So I had a crash course in racist language.
And coming from Saudi, you just hadn't had that at all.
So not at all. No. The idea of racism or people. No, I don't think I'd even massively noticed skin colour before particularly. So now when I look back at photographs of the kids I was at school with in Saudi, it's actually a very diverse mix of students, some white, some non-white. I don't think it ever really occurred to me that there are different sort of colours, really. And in Saudi Arabia, the Arab population is a bit more diverse as well. And there's a lot of visitors to Saudi when you go to Mecca or Medina who are from all over the world. Just didn't really notice it. Definitely noticed it when I was back in Birmingham full time. The secondary school I went to, so a Small Heath school, when I failed 11 plus, everyone was basically like me. So it's very, very South Asian dominant cohort of students all drawn from the local area. So that was a completely different experience. Camp Hill, the grammar school for my A-levels, was more diverse. But in each of these places, as different as they were, I never felt that out of place. There was always other people that sort of understood who we are and what our lives are like. Oxford was the very first time where I was meeting people for whom I was literally the first Muslim they'd ever met in their life. That was very odd. And then I also then knew everything they will ever know or believe about Muslims will start with their experience of me.
No pressure.
No pressure. I definitely felt that pressure because lots of people ask you questions about your faith. God, everyone used to ask about arranged marriages all the time. And I used to honestly think, God, I can't answer this just as myself. I have to answer it for about a billion people. And there's just so much variety and loads of it is cultural and not even religious. So yeah, I had to Google a lot about what Shias think about X, Y, and Z because I'm a Sunni Muslim. And so it got a bit complicated.
Now, this could be wrong, but was Rishi Sunak a contemporary?
Oh God, yeah. I'm never ever going to leave Rishi Sunak behind.
And he once voted for you. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, he was in the year above me. Okay. And I didn't do any party politics at Oxford. So I wasn't involved in like the Labour Club or any of that. I did
why not? Did you feel party political at that time? Or?
I was definitely party political. So I was very active back at home. In my teenage years, that's when I first started going out with my dad and, you know, delivering leaflets and knocking on doors for the Labour Party. I think I developed a view of students who were very party political that, you know, they all basically thought they were going to run the world and maybe quite intense and not an environment in which I felt massively comfortable.
I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, I was a bit, you know, a slightly old head on young shoulders. So I was a bit of a misfit for student life generally anyway, I reckon, but definitely for party political life at Oxford, where lots of people are planning their future political careers and it was not really my scene. So yeah, but I was very involved in the life of the college and I ran for JCR president, which is basically the student union of the college. And this is not a party political
it's a bit more fun
at all. Yeah, exactly. And it's about who's your student voice to the college authorities. And Rishi was in the year above me and I definitely canvassed him for his vote. I had him on my yes column 100% because I was mobilising the geek vote and he's a geek like me. And
did he take much persuading? Do you remember?
No, I think he was pretty bolted on from the start, actually. I don't recall having to work very hard to win over his vote. I'm sure he voted for me for the simple fact that one of his contemporaries who was in the same year as him who did vote for me and was a supporter of mine got in touch actually when this story surfaced. He said, if the Prime Minister ever tries to deny it, I was there. I'm your independent witness. We voted for you together. So it is true. It is true.
So do you guys remember one another?
Well, I didn't see him after that. So once he left college, our paths did not cross until it was 2015. I was opening for the Labour Party from the dispatch box, a debate, I think it was on productivity, and he intervened on me. And I'd just been really rude about all the Tory backbenchers, you know, because they were like a little bit of a boy band operation asking whips questions. And you know how we feel about people who ask whips questions. So I just sort of like... I think I just shredded them and then it was Rishi Sunak and I was like, oh my God, I know you. Oops.
Now, you obviously finish at university as you qualify as a barrister and you start kind of working, but you were also a very young MP. So I wondered, could you talk us through at what point do you start to go from, I suppose, what had been your dream job
Absolutely.
Of being a barrister, which is a majority, to thinking, actually, this is a dream job, but there's another job.
Yeah. So not until almost I got selected, to be perfectly honest. So as I say, being a barrister was my absolute dream. And that was the job I was doing. And I was loving being a barrister. But I'd done a thing that I think a lot of people do, especially if you're Oxbridge and, you know, you're trying to be a barrister, which is just assume that London is the place to come to do your pupillage and qualify and have your practice. And much as I love London, it's not really my city. Birmingham is very much my city. So I had this life where I had all my work life in London and then all of my family and social life and all my friends and everybody else were back in Birmingham. So I felt like I was living on what was then the Virgin train service between the two cities. And I felt like I needed to make a big life decision as to whether I was going to commit to a legal career in London, you know, for basically the rest of my life, or whether I was going to reset up as a barrister in Birmingham instead. So I happened to be home on a career break trying to work this out. And I was in a really privileged position where I had options in London and I had big options in Birmingham as well. So I felt like I could take a little bit of time and make a decision that I would then stick at. And then the Labour Party was selecting its candidate in Ladywood. And I didn't really think that that was a selection for me. I was 26 at the time. So as I say, I'm trying to still, you know, work through my career and get really established. I was only sort of 3 years into practice, very junior. As I describe myself now as a Shadow Lord Chancellor, I was a baby barrister. I was very, very sort of new in still. And a few people asked me if I was interested in running because I was active in the Birmingham Labour Party and the wider West Midlands as well. And I completely dismissed it because I said, can you imagine? I go up to a member and say, vote for me, and they'd laugh and they say, you're too young, come back in 20 years. And so I didn't, I dismissed it for a long time until shortly before the selection started, I saw an interview with an MP from Birmingham on the telly, and they were sort of chatting about something that was going on in their constituency. And I just had this really deep feeling that in 20 years' time, I'd like watch another interview and I think that could have been me. And I would really regret not having had a shot. And I thought that was probably too big a regret to live with in the future. And so I then just decided, why not have a go? It'll be a funny story I'll tell in the rest of my life where I'll say, let me tell you about that time I tried to become a Labour MP. And that was sort of the attitude I started it with. But one thing I do, which is, I didn't know that about myself then, but I do now, which is when I decide I'm going to do something, I am absolutely in it to win it. So the genesis of it was very much, I'm going to have a go, let's see, funny story, ha ha. And then when I started it, I was like, no, I'm going to do this properly.
And then you're all in.
I was all in. I mean, I knew not just the names and addresses of every single member of the Labour Party in Birmingham Ladywood. I knew their children's dates of birth. So I knew their grandchildren's names. I knew their pets. I knew everything about these people. I was absolutely then committed.
I know we're not allowed to say any seat is safe because you never know, but I think your seat is the seventh safest in the country. And at the last election, you got a majority of 68%. So you ultimately, you know, you get this seat, and then it feels like you potentially just have a new lifestyle, a job for life potentially.
Well, one of the things that was precipitating my kind of career decision about being a barrister in London or Birmingham was I felt fed up about living on the train service between Birmingham and London. And funnily enough, when I ended up switching careers slightly unexpectedly, I ended up living on the train service between Birmingham and London. So that bit of my life definitely did not change. I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it as a career because I didn't really ever think of politics as a career. I knew lots of members of Parliament from fairly young age, campaigned with lots of the Birmingham MPs and in their election campaigns. But I never, ever looked at them and thought that's a job that I could do. In my conception, that wasn't really a job. Maybe it's a bit immigrant mentality, but it's quite, you know, set in tram lines. You do law, you become a barrister or a solicitor, you do accounting and you become an accountant. And it's all very kind of set career paths. And I think if I'd said to not just my parents, but anyone of their generation, like, I'm going to do politics at university, they'd say, why? What, like, how is that? You're supposed to become a politician because you've done politics at university. So it was just a bit outside of what my conception of, you know, study and work and the relationship between the two is. So I never, ever thought about it. And then suddenly I did have this other job.
And then you do have this other job and you're elected and it's 2010 and Labour's out of power.
I timed it so well, didn't I? 14 years of opposition and counting.
Yeah. Did much surprise you once you got to Parliament? Well, it must have been, you know, I've just been at something today where, you know, there are some Tories coming up with the angle that if Labour win the next election, obviously an if, is a great time for new Tory MPs because you can climb up. Was that your experience as a Labour MP when the Tories suddenly just got in?
We were all so gutted to have lost. And if you remember, there was that weird period where people thought we could form a minority government, and obviously before the coalition deal was done between the Tories and the Lib Dems. And so it was an odd time, and it was like a period of grief almost, but not a grief that you're directly a part of. Lots of the other MPs that were still around who'd just come out of government, they were clearly processing that as a massive change. And then we're new and a bit younger and we're fresher in, but we're trying to learn in this atmosphere. There was definitely a sense of the strife between the Blairites and the Brownites still being a bit of a hangover post-election. But as a new MP, I'd barely been to Parliament before. I'd certainly never actually been into Westminster Hall or the Chamber before. And for me, it wasn't just being a new workplace. I mean, I was genuinely almost in awe of the place and what it means. And that carried me through for most of the first few weeks.
Now, of course, it's a limited time podcast, so I won't go through every single job you've ever had. But I suppose just to bring listeners up to speed, I think I'm correct to say you served under Ed Miliband, Keir Starmer. You supported both Yvette Cooper and Owen Smith.
Yes.
In their bids for the leadership, and you did not serve under Jeremy Corbyn.
I did not.
So for our listeners, on the scale of where you sit in the Labour Party, we once had Lisa Nandy on. She said she was probably soft left, even though it sounded a bit like a jellyfish breed or something. But, you know, are you on the... Would you say you're kind of on the right of the Labour Party or centre? Or how would you define it? Because I know anything I say will probably be wrong, but just to give our listeners a flavour.
Yeah, so I think I've always struggled to define... Because it's all kind of already set before you come in. On lots of things, you could say maybe I'm a bit to the right of the Labour Party, but sometimes I'm not even sure. Like on the economy, for example, you know, I've got quite strong views about fiscal credibility, being trusted with the nation's money. But I do obviously believe, as you'd expect from Labour people, the state has a role to play in making sure that the economy is growing, in the way that we collaborate with business, you know. And so that is a bit more on, you know, what you might describe as the traditional, more slightly more interventionist side. Definitely believe in regulation, good regulation, well understood regulation. So yes, a bit left and right, I guess. So it brings me more to the centre, I suppose, which centrism has had a bad rep in recent times.
Could be coming back.
But it's, yeah, probably. So... And then, you know, maybe on social issues or sort of broader society, probably described as a small C conservative. Again, lots of people define that in their own way. But I tend to think change happens incrementally over a period of time. And you have to think about us as a collective society, not just individuals. We all have an impact on each other. That probably puts me in the small C conservative brigade. So, again, I would say probably centre, because, you know, I still support, you know, lots of the causes and the liberation movements that we've seen over the last 20 years, but with a disposition, I guess, that is, you know, let's make sure we think about broader society, what this means for the collective, not just the individual. So, yeah, that's why I think I'm a bit less easy to define. Maybe centre is probably the best way to describe it. I think some of my opponents will always say she's to the right of the Labour Party.
So probably not to the right of the Spectator. So.
Well, very we'll, no, no,
we'll
definitely
find,
to the left
we'll
of the
find out by the end of the podcast. Now, you mentioned earlier your faith, and I just wondered, you know, as one of the first female Muslim MPs too, I mean, how important is religion to you?
My religion, my faith, my belief in God is the absolute center point of who I am. It's the thing from which I draw my purpose in life and also my sense of identity and who I am. So it's very personal. It's a very personal spiritual relationship with God. I feel my own conscience and my conscience calls me to God. I was raised by Muslim parents. So, you know, I had a very religious upbringing in a household where faith was a real central part of who we are and what we do and how we live our life. But I always say, I know I felt like I was a proper grown up when I could say that I am a Muslim on my own terms because my conscience calls me to God. It's no longer just because of my upbringing. And that at that point, I knew who I am and I knew what my life is about. And I always knew that wherever I am in the world, whatever happens to me, I will always have that core of who I am and what I believe. So in that respect is absolutely the core that runs through me. In terms of politics, I think that's slightly different because one of the things I believe really strongly, and it's a really big part of Islam, is, you know, this is about your personal relationship with God. You don't impose your beliefs on other people. There's no compulsion in religion, is how we often describe it. So I've never in my political life sought to impose my beliefs on other people. I think your job as a politician is, of course, you have your own beliefs that you apply to yourself and you should be open about those. But your responsibility as a politician is to think of the collective, and that's people of different faiths, people of no faith, everybody in between. And in a way, my political disposition is shaped by my religious beliefs, but my political practice is a bit more, I guess, shaped by my position as a lawyer when I try to balance out issues and think about longer term consequences.
Yeah, because I'm not sure if you've been following Kate Forbes and the SNP.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, because it's just quite an interesting one where obviously a different faith, but a Christian.
Yeah, yes.
And when she was thinking about going first minister the second time, some people were saying some of her religious views.
Yeah.
But she said that she wouldn't make policy.
Absolutely.
Kind of made her unfit. And I just wondered, you know, do you think kind of a politician's religious views they shouldn't preclude them from high office, if that makes sense. Because sometimes there is a bit of that sense of that in some of the narratives.
Yeah, and I think the way that some people reacted to Kate Forbes' first time round running in her campaign, and also the second time round, I think that's disgraceful, frankly. I thought that was really out of order. She's done what politicians should be, which is be open and honest. She's explained where her religious beliefs would and would not affect her position on policy issues of the day. And what more can you do than be honest? I mean, would you really say that the people that are from more... what's the right word? Are they orthodox traditions of Christianity or the Free Church? I think it is in Scotland.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You couldn't. Yeah, you wouldn't say that they're not allowed to have any political representation, would you? I mean, that would be wrong on point of principle. So I think that the way people reacted to that was really out of order, and it's not British. That's not the British way. And actually, we should welcome people being open and honest. And she was really incredibly nuanced as well, I thought, in the way that she explained her position. Yeah, I think that's right.
And I won't spend the entire podcast talking about religious schools, but we've obviously just had the local election results.
Yes.
And I think you can say pretty good result for Labour, no matter what some pollsters might say.
Yeah, yes. In my previous job, it was my life to explain why they were slightly wrong.
Yeah, because of course you were involved in the Labour campaign before your newest brief, which we will come on to.
That's right, yeah.
What did you think of that West Midlands result?
Honestly, what a nail biter. It was a very long day on Saturday whilst we waited for the recount in Coventry. But honestly, I was so delighted we got over the line. We followed our data. We knew exactly how much work we had to do to really turn out our vote on the day, and we knew it was on a knife edge from this last 7 days in. We knew it was a knife edge. We knew every single conversation was going to count, and we executed the campaign, I think, really, really well. I was really proud of the campaign team, even though I don't run it directly anymore. Yeah. But I was very proud of the whole operation.
Still say you influenced it.
Yes, exactly. I built the foundations. Exactly. I did tell Pat McFadden when he took over as the NCC, if it all goes well, I'm taking credit because the foundations are all me.
Chipping through the data, I think the local election analysis by Sky News said that the Labour vote had dropped the most in areas with the highest number of Muslim voters. And I just wonder, what do you think is going on there? Because, I mean, some people say, you know, for example, is there such a thing as a Muslim vote, a Jewish vote, some of this kind of...
Yeah, and I've had to sort of think about those issues a lot over my career. And my practice has always been never to think of anybody as belonging to a bloc vote. Voters vote on a range of issues. But I think sometimes some issues are so big and looming so large in conversations, at kitchen tables all over the country, that they are obviously going to impact on voting behaviour. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, people are entitled to their views and they're entitled to prioritise some issues ahead of others. There's perfectly legitimate thing for people to do. And I've discussed before and I've said before, I think that the situation in Gaza, the perception of our position and things that have happened has obviously led to a loss of trust between us and large numbers of people, primarily but not exclusively from the British Muslim community, who are traditional Labour voters, who are not as happy to be thinking about the Labour Party at the moment and who didn't vote for us this time. I think, as Keir acknowledged after the result, these are Labour voters who we want to work with, earn their trust back. We have heard the message that they have sent.
Yeah, so taking some steps to do that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, what do you think that looks like?
I think, you know, it's partly about earning the right to be heard again, because if you look at the substance of our policy position, and of course our policy position has changed, but I think we haven't necessarily earned that right to be heard on those, either on the changes, but also on the substance of our position, which has always been to push for a two-state solution. That has been long-term Labour Party policy, long-term policy to recognise the state of Palestine as well. But I think when you have... whether because of miscommunication or otherwise, you have a schism, it's very hard to then get back and win that trust back. But that's what we have to do. And it's individual conversations, house by house, street by street.
Now I want to talk about your current brief.
Okay.
So when Keir Starmer gave you the role, obviously, if you think about your previous role as a barrister, it seems like your dream job on paper. And I think you've just been doing jury service.
Just
before it, so another perspective.
Homework.
When you can't, when do you ever, like, I don't know how it's in shadow cabinet and cabinet, do you like hint that there are jobs that you want? Is that how, or like, does it come out of the blue?
I don't know if other people do it, but I've never done it. I think, you know, I was enjoying the elections job, but of course everybody wants to have a brief of their own and everybody dreams of running their own department. If I'd been asked, I would have said this is my dream job, of course, given the job I used to do.
But they probably could have joined the dots, couldn't they?
Yeah, it's kind of straightforward, isn't it? I'm glad they joined the dots in the obvious way.
And I suppose now you're in the brief. At the moment, there's a problem in terms of overcrowding in prisons. Mm-hmm. There's a chance that you inherit a situation, you know, predictions of riots, of overcrowding in the summer could soon be your problem. Are you, I suppose, intimidated, or what's your plan of action?
Oh, well, there is no disguising the absolute mess that the Tories have made of not just the prison system, but the broader justice system. So the problems are bigger than just criminal justice, but criminal justice is obviously what impacts most on ordinary citizens. And yeah, prisons overcrowded, but also we just don't have enough places. I mean, this country hasn't built enough prison places for a long time, and certainly not for the last 14 years, where there have been quite dire warnings about the need for more prison capacity. But then you also have a court's backlog. Victims are trapped in that system for years on end, waiting for resolution of their cases. But also, if you're a defendant who's ultimately acquitted, you know, you've spent a long time as well with your life on hold. And right in the middle of it, you've got a probation system that the government is asking to do more work, but it's basically on its knees. So let's be no doubt, they have totally car crashed this system, and it is a very, you know, difficult inheritance for whoever forms the next government as well. I think this government is aware of that. So yeah, it's a dream job, but it's going to be a huge challenge. There's no doubting that if we win the election, the Justice Department, as it is at the moment under this government, is going to be pretty high up on the risk register of problem areas. And you're right, for this government, there is a constant worry that the overcrowding and the lack of prison capacity might mean there are multiple riots. You could have big system failure in any day, and I'm sure Alex Chalk is losing sleep over it. And if we win, I'm sure I'll be losing sleep over it for quite a long time to come. We have changes that we want to make immediately, so we will move faster than this government on planning, changes to planning, so that we can deliver prison capacity. And there are other things that we would like to do to make sure that the nation does not long-term keep running out of prison places. But there's no doubt that for some years to come, the justice system is in a bad way, and it is going to be extremely difficult.
And I think you've been speaking in the comments about this today, but one of the problems Alex Chalk is encountering at the moment is effectively, there's a sentencing bill. It's quite unpopular with the Tory right. It would mean, you know, effectively stopping jail time for some lower level crimes. Obviously, it takes time to build prisons, but also there's, I suppose, an argument of, I think the trend has been longer sentences for some time. Do you think there's an argument for locking fewer people up in the future when it comes to, I suppose, more the petty crimes, perhaps to reduce the chance of reoffending? Is that something?
So I think there's a couple of things there. Firstly, when you run out of prison places, which is essentially what's happened, you know, we're at 98% or 99% capacity most weeks. When you're in that position, every option on the table is a bad option. It's not really a choice you want to be making. But what you definitely don't want to be doing is making bigger, broader changes in an emergency situation, right? So I think there is a conversation to be had about sentencing. The conversation is less about sentencing and actually more about rehabilitation, because we have to, as a nation, we have to find this holy grail of being able to help more people in the prison system ultimately turn their lives around. That is a strategy, not just for helping those offenders, but it's actually a strategy for cutting crime. Because if these people are in that revolving door, in and out of prison, that's more victims, more lives affected, and they're a huge cost and burden to us as a society as well. So you do have to crack that tough nut of rehabilitation. If you're doing better on rehabilitation, I think you can then think more creatively about the best use of your sentencing powers, but only in the context of that you're still cutting crime and reducing the number of victims overall. You know, you break our rules, you do have to be punished. Like, prison has a place. And I'm also very clear, I think that the offender has to make the decision to change. But once they've made that decision and want to engage with rehabilitation programs, improve their literacy, all of that sort of stuff, the state should be a partner with them. Because at that point, we have a vested interest as well. Because if they do succeed, we're all better off. So I think that's where the conversation really should be. The stuff around sentencing then follows through if you've succeeded ended on rehabilitation. What the government's ended up doing is they've run out of places. So now everything is emergency, backs to the wall, what can I do? And therefore, you're not really thinking through the wider consequences. So on the sentencing bill, they put loads of pressure. If they had managed to pass the bill, which has now disappeared, but if they tried to pass it, all that pressure goes to probation. But nothing in the sentencing bill or the policy around it spoke about the probation service. So if you do it piecemeal, sticking plaster, as Keir would say, it just won't work.
Now, I want to talk a bit about gender within the Labour Party, because I think you've given praise to J.K. Rowling previously. And of course, the Labour Party has been a bit of a journey in terms of the question of what is a woman. Mm. What's your position on it? And is it right to say that you've kind of been perhaps edging the party towards where it is now?
My views are fairly well known. I believe in the importance of recognising biological sex. It's immutable and it is fundamental to how the vast majority of women understand their existence on this earth and also how they relate to other parts of society. So that's my start point. Of course, I also want to stand up for the rights of trans people, right to live free from discrimination, the right to be respected, in workplaces and so on. But I've never sought to pretend that the two sets of rights don't clash sometimes in some circumstances. And I think one of the real patterns, not just in this issue, but it's been most obvious in this issue, but it happens in other places as well, is where people try to behave as if a clash of rights doesn't exist. All lawyers would be out of business if human rights weren't clashing. And maybe people don't think that's a good thing, but still, human rights clash. They clash fairly regularly. The courts are full of cases trying to resolve the way in which you then find a solution. You accommodate around people, or one set of people wins in a certain circumstance. That is the bread and butter of how equality law works in this country. And I think people trying to say, well, there's no clash here, I've always found that quite frustrating at the beginning of this debate. And it was obvious there were going to be scenarios in which the rights of biological women to sex-segregated spaces...
Yeah, women's only spaces.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Were going to come into clash with the desire of people to be trans-inclusive as well. So those have always been my views. I would not have voted in favour of a bill on self-ID on demand, for example. That was our policy under Jeremy Corbyn as well. But I was always very clear that that was not a future bill that I would support. I won't lift the lid on private conversations and how positions develop, but I make my views known. And I think where the party is today is the right position. And I think that that's where the country is. But I think it's actually also the common sense position. Of course, you want to be inclusive wherever possible, but you do have to recognise sex segregation has a place, not just for safety, but for the dignity of women as well.
And just the final thing, I mentioned J.K. Rowling, but you also have your Labour colleague, Rosie Duffield. Mm. And I think she obviously she's been on this podcast previously. She obviously has spoken a bit about how she feels as though some figures in the party haven't had those conversations with her. Do you think she's had a rough time of it? Or...
Yes, I think that's objectively and subjectively true. It's clearly been very difficult. I feel a bit uncomfortable talking about a colleague when I haven't discussed it with her in advance of coming on. So it's her story to tell. I feel that very strongly. But it's clear that she has attracted a huge amount of hostility and abuse from certain groups for views that are perfectly legitimate and I would say shared by millions and millions of our fellow citizens. And I'm very sorry that she's felt unsupported. I know that that's not the intention, and I know that Keir has addressed this on a few occasions as well, but all I can say is that her position about women's rights is a position I share. It's a position that many others in the party share and millions of citizens share as well, and she should never ever have faced or continue to face any hostility for that.
Now, I've just got three final questions. Just one, we were talking a bit about obviously religious and politics, and there are some issues that are conscience issues.
Yes.
Now, for example, the Tories would say a smoking ban is a conscience issue.
Labour, I'm not so sure about that.
Labour does not. No. So Labour's whipped on that one. But there's two quite interesting issues obviously coming up the track.
Yes.
So one is, of course, the Criminal Justice Bill, and the fact there's an amendment which would effectively decriminalise abortion in terms of limits. And I just wanted to, where do you sit on that in terms of what's your position?
So I mean, I have my own beliefs, you know, my religious beliefs, which I apply to myself, but I have also always supported a woman's right to choose. I believe life begins at conception, but that's not, you know, that's not something I would legally impose on other people. So I support a woman's right to choose. So I would favour decriminalisation because I think in the end, this is abortion is best seen in a medical context, and I would like to take the sort of criminal element out of it. I don't think criminalising often very vulnerable women in a very difficult situation is the right way for our society to go. On the specifics of what's coming up in the criminal justice bill, what I want to make sure is that we don't do anything that effectively renders the time limits meaningless or, you know, weakened in some way. I think the time limits are really important and crucial. I don't support any lowering of the time limit. I think 24 weeks is sensible and the right place for us to be. But I do think that the time limits have to mean something in practice. And one of the difficulties we've got is that the introduction of telemedicine, which is where women can have an online consultation, have the pills sent to them in the post and take the pills at home, something introduced during the pandemic and then extended. I think that creates a tension, and we saw that in the case of Carla Foster about late-term abortions outside of the legal time limits, where actually I think there's a bit of a grey area. So I wouldn't support decriminalisation where the time limit is affected. And I do think we need to sort out this tension with telemedicine, which a lot of women support. But for me, if I had a choice between decrim or telemedicine, I'd pick decriminalisation.
Yeah, well, the two together. I think the other issue coming up the track clearly is a debate about assisted dying.
Right, yeah.
And I think particularly if Keir Starmer does become Prime Minister, but even now you can see, you know, in the Tory party, and that would also likely be a free vote. It feels the tide is probably turning in a way where I think people are becoming more supportive of assisted dying. Matthew Paris's recent column aside, which turns me back. What do you think about it in terms of what it would mean as a I suppose a vote or something in the Commons?
Well, this is also a conscience issue, so it is a free vote. I didn't support it in 2015, and I don't intend to support it in the future. And again, I guess partly, of course, I have a belief in the preservation of life and the sanctity of life. But again, thinking about how you have a system that is appropriate for lots of different types of people, what I really feel uncomfortable about is this idea of the state becoming the mechanism by which death also occurs. Because I think the state is the preserver of life. And I think you're either one or the other. I feel that once you cross that line, you've crossed it forever. And it's a subtle thing. It's a cultural thing. I think that once these changes are made, I think the pressures on people, that sense of being a burden to society. And again, it's not, I know some of the MPs who really vocally support this issue think, for God's sake, you know, we're not a nation of granny killers. Like, what's wrong with you? But this is where your right to do things for yourself isn't like in a vacuum, because it does affect, therefore, the culture that everybody else lives in. And if it just becomes the norm that at a point, a certain age or with certain diseases, that you're now a bit of a burden, people think, well, why haven't you, you know, basically decided to end it? I think that's a really dangerous position to be in. But also, I'm worried about the sort of social pressure that potentially puts on disabled people, the social pressure on, I think, often vulnerable women. You know, the state could end up sanctioning what are ultimately, you know, not genuine cases of assisted dying, but something that looks and feels a bit more like a criminal case, like a wrongful death. And any one of those, I think, is too high a price to pay for individual autonomy on the other side. And I know it's very difficult. And I know that, you know, it's actually a very emotive issue. It's very tough. But I think my position and my aversion to going down this road is as strong today as it was in 2015, the last time it was debated. I just think it's the thin end of the wedge, and you should be careful about some of the lines that you cross. And when it's the state as an entity, changing the culture and the sort of innovating purpose of the state, I think, is a really big thing to do. I don't think it's a minor change that we're making here.
And kind of to your point earlier, things that can seem well-meaning or, yes, you know, like you kind of need to apply that analytical sense to it in terms of the cross of rights.
Exactly. I think in a way you almost have to have a bit of detachment and then think about it system-wide. Here you are all as individuals making choices. Sure, that's good. but it impacts on the wider society that you want to be in as well. And one choice over here for one person probably affects 100 other people over here that you haven't really thought about yet. So not dissimilar, actually, from the clash of rights between trans people and women in terms of the bigger philosophical questions that it makes us ask of ourselves.
Now it's time for the final question, because I've taken too much of your time, which is just, what is the worst advice you've ever been given? And we've had a mix on this podcast. I think Ruth Davidson was told she needed to lose weight, at some point. Some people were told they had to change their accents. Some people were just told, not to be too pushy. Are you allowed to give us more than one piece if you want to?
I'm sure you've been
given quite a lot of bad advice.
I've been given all of those pieces of advice. Probably the worst ones are all personal appearance related, in which I would just say to people, you need to be confident in yourself. And that's all that really matters. But yes, no, I've had, across my life, I've had all of those bits of advice that are designed to knock your confidence. And I think one of my other sort of personal examples that's always stuck with me, and this is before I learned lessons about sort of being confident and actually just making your own decisions, a teacher at school, at my grammar school, basically said I shouldn't apply to Oxford, that it was a wasted application, and that I wasn't so far ahead academically, and I should be more realistic about where I was going to go. A part of my brain knew it was rubbish because all my other teachers were basically encouraging me, but it really did knock me for six. And one of the things I learned from it afterwards is sometimes it's a little bit like my experiences as an adult trying to understand what happened to me with the 11 plus failure is sometimes people project onto you what they think, and sometimes they're just trying to get in your head, and actually you just need to keep them out. But yeah, as a 17 and a half year old, that really bothered me for quite a long time. But eventually I just thought, no, you're wrong, and there's probably something wrong with you, not me. And anyway, I did apply, and it had a big impact on my life, so it was fine. It worked out well.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And if you'd like to send us your feedback on this podcast or any other many podcasts, please do get in touch. Just email us at podcast@spectator.co.uk.